Good morning. It is 8:59. This is KBOO Portland, and coming up next, the Olmo Variety Hour. The topics include how to combine electoral politics with grassroots movements to support radical political turnout, a call to disarm the transit police in the wake of the Terrell Johnson shooting, and the organizer of Death by a Thousand Cuts, a public education funding town hall.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Johnnata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Johnnata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 22nd Monday, and Joe Clement is our engineer and banjo player this morning. It's membership drive. We're hoping folks will call in and become members if you haven't already become members, or renew if you need to do that, and support KBOO and programs like the Old Mole. This morning, we'll hear Bill Resnick and Brian Tokar discuss municipalism and how to combine electoral politics with grassroots movements to build support and a radical political turn. Brian Tokar is an activist, author, and lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Vermont, and he is an author, and Bill will tell you more about his work. Desiree Helligers talks with Hui Ong of OPAL, Environmental Justice Oregon, about the shooting of Terrell Johnson and the upcoming TriMet meeting on the transit police. And I, your host, Denise Morris, will talk with Portland Public Schools teacher Rachel Haynes. She is the organizer of a recent town hall that was on Saturday, May 20th, Death by a Thousand Cuts, a public education funding town hall. We'll start now with Bill Resnick and Brian Tokar.
Thanks, Denise. Brian Tokar, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Always great to be here.
Yes, Brian Tokar is an author of The Green Alternative, Earth for Sale. His most recent book is Toward Climate Justice. In addition to his writing and lots of activism and organizing, Brian Tokar has been on the board of the Institute for Social Ecology that promotes the radical democratization of U.S. cities and, in fact, the whole country. Brian, you wrote in a ISE, Institute for Social Ecology blog, a brief piece. It's on, and I quote you here, "An emerging municipal uprising in several U.S. cities, actually quite a number, mirroring developments in Europe, that in response to the failure of statist politics and anticipating increasing attacks on basic human rights by the new U.S. administration." Brian, tell us about that municipal uprising, some particulars.
Well, as people know, in response to the, at this point, more than daily outrages coming out of Washington, people have been looking for new ways to organize. And in many cities around the country, some of the best covered have been in Seattle and New York, but also several places in the Deep South. People have gone back to what's really a long-standing tradition of popular assemblies in response to various political outrages. And there's a long history of people organizing in that way. Of course, currents from the French Revolution all the way up through movements of the 60s, and more recently, circumstances like the popular response to the severe economic crisis that hit Argentina, documented in some of Naomi Klein and also Marina Citrin's work, kind of rekindling interest in assembly-based democracy. Here in New England, of course, it goes back to the tradition of town meetings which started during the colonial period, started really as very conservative institutions, but in the period leading up to the American Revolution, as documented in some of Murray Bookchin's research and his historical work called The Third Revolution, New England town meetings became increasingly open and participatory and radical and forward-looking in their agendas. And that's a tradition that has thrived to the present day here in this part of the country, but also in many cities, people organizing on a citywide scale or in many places, as in Seattle, by neighborhood, really trying to take the power back from institutions that have consistently proven to be unaccountable to the needs of the people.
Yeah, and let me add to the list, actually. It's quite enormous when you look at the whole United States and, of course, Europe, especially in this austerity period in Spain and Portugal and Greece and now Italy and across Europe, actually, city governments and the popular assemblies pushing them, that is, popular movements and assemblies pushing them, as in Germany, around energy, there's a tremendous amount of autonomous action now in cities. Brian, why don't you tell us about, in fact, Burlington, your experience? I'm sure that almost nobody knows. In fact, you've been in Burlington, around Burlington, living in Vermont for many, many years, even predating Bernie Sanders' mayoralty.
Right.
But you watched him very carefully and worked with him some, that is the ISE and movements, and also opposed him some and forced him into doing things that he didn't want to do at the beginning. Why don't you tell us that story?
Well, in terms of the development of more democratic institutions at the city level, that's something that very much wasn't on Bernie's agenda when he first got elected mayor back in 1981. But people in his community development office developed a plan for creating kind of temporary neighborhood meetings, basically to administer federal community development block grant funds. And when that opportunity arose, a number of us, informed by the ideas of social ecology and the confederal municipalism that Murray Bookchin put forward from a theoretical and strategic perspective, and we can get a little bit more into that, you know, we started saying these should be permanent institutions. They should be governing bodies for the neighborhoods. City council members should be accountable to people through their neighborhood assemblies. And while we didn't quite accomplish those structural changes, the neighborhood assemblies in Burlington continue to this day and have been important centers of resistance to all sorts of outrageous projects by the city's elites. Burlington has actually got a mayor now who's a Democrat and a major real estate developer, and a lot of the resistance to that agenda is coming from neighborhood assemblies. But even back in the 80s, when Bernie was mayor, he was allied with developers on a number of issues, including waterfront development, which some articles during the presidential primary campaign gave Bernie credit for saving the Burlington waterfront. In fact, the people I give credit to for saving the Burlington waterfront were green activists and others in town who in many cases had to say no and organize resistance through neighborhood meetings to various development projects that Bernie actually supported.
Yeah, Brian, we're going to continue. I would like to continue the interview, this conversation right now, but necessity requires us to attend to the survival, that is the continued operation of this independent, non-commercial, small-d democratic radio station. It's the breath of life here in Portland.
Absolutely.
It is, as we say, it pierces the corporate veil, keeps hope for democracy and sustainable alive. Who's at Membership Central? Will, are you there too?
Will is here.
Why don't you tell us about how people can, in fact, support KBOO, volunteer here, work here, come see us, come meet us. become part of the KBOO family and certainly support us financially so that we're on the air.
Well, that's right, Bill. Where else can you find this? I hate to use the cliche right off the bat, but where else can you find this? So please pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266.
877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm, the donate button.
And you can also donate online by looking us up at kboo.fm. But also, one way I recommend is come down to KBOO. Come down to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Hey, thank you, folks. We're back to content on KBOO Radio, our wonderful radio stations. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I've been talking to Brian Tokar. We're going to continue the interview. Brian, you're there. We talked earlier, we gave a lot of examples of this uprising that you wrote briefly about, but it's happening all over the world, and especially in municipalities. People live near one another, they feel what's happening, and they organize. But it's a complex process to really democratize a city. We talked a little bit about Burlington and how it happened in response to Bernie Sanders pushing him to change policies in all sorts of ways as the neighborhoods rebelled. How do you keep it all going? What is the relationship do you see between electoral politics and official Burlington or official Barcelona or official Seattle and the neighborhood movements, how they come together in a place like Barcelona? Of course, it was very interesting because it was a number of movements. First, just anti-eviction and trying to protect the city against gentrification. Then came the great crisis, the economic crisis in Spain, and it became a jobs and employment movement. Then it became a political movement and elected the mayor. How do you see that all occurring, the relationship between the local and the city officials and the movements that began around single issues?
Yeah, I think Barcelona is an incredible example because it's one where a political alliance that was really rooted in neighborhoods and rooted in issue-oriented work that wasn't initially really set up to be a political party, but rather an expression of neighborhood-based and citywide grassroots institutions, really found its way to taking power in the mayor's office. And in many ways, that mirrors, in some ways more closely than any other example I can think of, a strategy that Murray Bookchin in his work started to lay out back in the 1980s and 90s. And what he proposed was a complete rethinking of politics, kind of really going back to the original ancient Greek notion of politics as the self-management of the polis being the city, through directly democratic popular assemblies that would then confederate among themselves in order to challenge centralized power in the form of both corporations and the state. And he laid out a strategy whereby people with a very consciously directly democratic agenda would develop a detailed program, organize their neighborhoods, develop popular assemblies, and then contest for power at the municipal level in order to institute a system where, as I suggested earlier, it was part of our vision for Burlington, city councilors would be directly accountable to neighborhood assemblies that would be the real decision-making bodies. People meeting citywide would be serving as accountable and recallable delegates rather than as representatives able to really vote based on their own inclinations and their own political connections rather than those of the people they're representing, and really work toward a dual power situation where grassroots institutions are really contesting for power, partly using the electoral system. And Bookchin was very much inspired in those days by the successes of the German Greens in their early years, which was much more of a movement-based institution than it eventually became when it started entering into political alliances with the Social Democrats and
right.
really
Brian, up Brian, we only have a minute and a half left. It doesn't, though, it's not completely spontaneous. It arises out of people's needs, but then to really become institutionalized, but to become, to survive, to be real active, living organizations, it seems to me there has to be lot incentives for people really to get involved and to actually make decisions and to have those decisions stick, particularly about resources. And I think, Brian, why don't you give a talk about that, and then discuss finally the ISE conference in San Francisco.
Yeah,
and we'll have to talk about this more.
To some resources, collection of Murray Bookchin's political writings from the 1990s that recently came out called The Next Revolution, some brilliant work done by people really originally coming out of the black nationalist milieu in Jackson, Mississippi. On their website, there's some terrific stuff about strategy around genuinely translating popular assemblies into institutions of political power, and then many links on the social ecology website, social-ecology.org, and as Bill mentioned, we're doing a six-day class, an intensive seminar in social ecology where we'll really get deeply into both the theoretical background and exploration of working models on the ground around these precise kinds of themes. And you can find the information on our website. It's the 10th to the 15th of June at the California Institute for Integral Studies in San Francisco.
Right. Brian, thanks. The Institute for Social Ecology, if you go to their website, you'll find out about the conference and other stuff. Brian, we'll have to do it again.
Absolutely. Always great to talk to you,
right,
Bill.
Thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah.
Call right now at 877-500-5266. Or you can donate online at kboo.fm. And also there's opportunities to volunteer here. I'm broke. I don't have any money. I would give my money to KBOO if I had it, but I do have time, so I volunteer my time. And we have a wonderful volunteer coordinator named Ani, and she does once a month the volunteer orientation. And if you don't have money to donate to KBOO, then come on down, join the volunteer orientation, and become part of KBOO. It's your community, and it is community radio.
What Will didn't mention yet, but I think is one of the most valuable parts of KBOO, is you can get free training here in the radio. And that includes audio production, how to use our production studios, digital editing, news reporting. There's a lot of citizen journalists here at KBOO.fm. Now back to the old mole.
Thanks, guys. Yes, Desiree Helgers now talks with Hui Ong of OPAL, Environmental Justice Oregon, about the shooting of Terrell Johnson and the upcoming TriMet meeting on the transit police. There are multiple demands being made following this tragic shooting. And of course, there was another recent incident involving TriMet and policing. So we'll go right to that interview now.
This TriMet board meeting has broader and deeper significance given that last week an officer from TriMet's Transit Police Division shot and killed a Portland man, Terrell Johnson, you know, who was only 24 years old. We've actually delayed a little bit about speaking out about the shooting with the hope that both TriMet and the city of Portland would help the community kind of understand and make a little sense of, you know, Terrell's death. And, you know, even the mayor, you know, Ted Wheeler, said in a statement after the shooting that information should be provided to the public in a timely and transparent manner. And yet we have heard nothing of substance from both TriMet or the city. And we're outraged. You know, we talked a lot about TriMet using or prioritizing the $11 million for this new transit police facility when riders are, you know, talking about other needed service improvements and other capital projects that should be prioritized. And we are really concerned that the level of accountability and transparency is not clear. So we are asking folks that are, you know, demanding questions answered. We're asking folks that want to hear about solutions to actually show up this Wednesday at the Portland building for the board meeting that starts at 9 a.m. you know, Old Boulevard Mental Justice and Bus Riders Unite believe that we can actually redefine what, you know, how fare enforcement can be handled. Where we believe that transit police should explore alternatives to deadly force. I think there's additional training, law enforcement and police that are on our transit systems should be trained on. What answers around what training do transit police officers have around de-escalation? Why is there really a need for the militarization of our transit police state, force? There's questions about why the use of sweeps where they have several heavily armed law enforcement, stand on top of a staircase checking everyone's, fare to do what? Is it really to identify who's not paying the fare, or is it to provide a sense of intimidation to riders? We wanna stop to the sweeps, and we want TriMet to really pause and create a space where community engagement is meaningful to actually start addressing these very grave concerns of ours about the safety of our communities riding public transit. We think that there are lots of situations where folks, because of mental health issues, because of poverty, are faced with being interrogated and then questions and then having an interaction with transit police that do not actually need to happen. There could be alternatives where, let's envision a world where there would actually be rider advocates on our transit system that can connect folks that actually need a different type of help to giving them access to those resources and figuring out ways to connect those communities that need help with the services that are out there. And this is something we would be willing to sit and work with both, our law enforcement and TriMet to actually start building out and envisioning a different way of doing what we call real community policing, and actually think about the safety of the broader community when it comes to engagement with, a wide range of our diverse group of riders. Why do transit police need to have the weaponized and the dogs on our transit system? It does not do anything other than to provide a sense of fear into the community. We've also have had affirmed engagement where we know they're not ICE and custom enforcement per se, but law enforcement through these sweeps have asked about immigration status. Now, I'm not saying that's a standard practice of either the Sheriff's Department or the Portland Police Department or any other law enforcement, but there are individuals within those agencies that have done things that probably do violate the law. Now, how does a community feel when that is a very visible presence, both in this time and age with the current administration, seeing a set of armed, uniformed law enforcement at the top of the stairs does not provide any safety to some communities that have been already historically targeted.
So particularly for people who are undocumented, riding TriMet then becomes a traumatic daily experience.
Yeah, and you would hear TriMet say they don't do any direct engagement with or cooperation with ICE, yet we see a practice used that if you are a person that is undocumented getting off a bus stop, even if you do or do not have a fare, like seeing armed set of uniformed law enforcement, it just is traumatic in both minds, right? We've hear from communities that see this in around schools. Even though a law enforcement agency might be dealing with some other issue, having their presence around a school, around a place of work or a particular road triggers real fear in the community. And we think there's a need to pause those types of tactics and actually re-examine what we're trying to do here. Are we really trying to build out a sanctuary supportive city community, and how is the different agencies working together to actually project that out throughout both our transit agencies, our law enforcement agencies, and our city government?
I think, too, it almost seems as if policing costs are being buried in the TriMet budget, right? One assumes that the TriMet budget is actually going to providing public transportation when instead we get what looks like a little bit of a shell game.
I think TriMet works with actually 36, about a little bit over 30 other like law enforcement agencies, and I have different agreements, and it's super complex. And we're asking the question, why is there that level of complexity? What are the real dangers that people are facing on and off our public transportation system? And what is actually being solved through this set of arrangements with, you know, regional law enforcement? Or is there actually a different way to, you know, offer solutions? And we think there's different ways. And I think it's, you know, we're challenging both the board and the leadership of TriMet to sit with us and think about what those solutions can be, and actually explore alternatives. Because I think sometimes people go down a pathway and they think that's the only pathway because that's the only way they know how. And we're letting them know that the community actually will be able to show them a different way and a different way to do fair enforcement.
Yeah, and presumably a different way of doing fair enforcement would also be to minimize the fare to begin with by putting those those funds away from law enforcement toward and away from detaining people for fare evasion, and instead giving people subsidized fares. Because as you've said before, so much of that fare evasion is coming from low-income people who are barely getting by, and people who've been forced from the urban core out to the periphery as a result of gentrification.
Imagine if the transit police station was revamped and it was an unarmed community engagement center, a hub where folks can go to both learn about resources, services that can actually help people that are in tough situations. That TriMet actually makes a commitment by using the facilities in a different way, right? We have real doubts if they would not spend $11 million on this new transit police facility. But why not reimagine this purpose? Reimagine what the community really needs and the relationship TriMet and its riders can build off a different use of that facility. You know, we are examining what rider advocates could really do to build trust within the agency and provide a real vital service, and connecting communities that could use those services through a different process, and actually having a hub in the central city would be pretty powerful in a very different way. One that actually builds trust and actually provides communities that need particular services to those services. Why not work with us to build out that different vision?
Mm-hmm. One that does not involve shooting unarmed people with mental health issues.
Absolutely.
So the hearing is coming up on Wednesday at 9 a.m.
It's at the Portland Building downtown. The auditorium at 1120 Southwest 5th Avenue. We encourage all that, you know, demand answers to show up and show support of transit-dependent folks.
And demanding answers for the killing of Terrell Johnson specifically, yeah.
Absolutely.
So we don't usually think about TriMet as a location for protests against police violence, but that's kind of the situation that we're looking at this time around.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I just want to remind people of the location of the meeting. It's at 9 a.m. this coming Wednesday at the Portland Building.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for this time.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with me, Huey.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. We are signing up members this morning.
Pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KABU. And you can pledge your support for this terrific show and this wonderful radio station. There are very, very few community radio stations, and especially like this, where you get local news. You can also pledge your support online at kboo.fm. It's super easy, very quick, and you'll be helping to keep your community alive and vital.
Thank you guys for that and your support of the Old Mole and KBOO. I'm here this morning with Rachel Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning.
We met just the other day at the town hall that you organized or co-organized. We want to talk about that. It was addressing the crisis in public schools. Let me tell folks about you a little bit so they have some idea of who you are. You're currently a second grade teacher and a former middle school special education teacher, something that sounds like becoming more rare. We can talk a little bit about that as part of how the cuts affect who gets to do what services are provided in the schools. You also serve on the executive board of the Portland Association of Teachers, and you're the chair of the Social Justice and Community Outreach Committee. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you organized a town hall.
Yeah, actually, I was listening to Democracy Now. Ralph Nader was on the show, and he said, you know, anyone can have a town hall, and it really inspired me. I thought, he's right. I could just call a town hall, and I really wanted to give an opportunity for legislators to listen to educators and to parents and to students about how continued disinvestment in schools really impacts the classroom and the profession. And so the idea was to invite all legislators on the House and Senate Revenue and Education Committees, and also people within who represented the Portland area. And five legislators attended, and then the community. And it was really set up to have a panel kind of giving the background of how we have come to this place where we're not in a recession, we have low unemployment, and yet we have a $1.4 billion deficit, and all the, you know, extreme cuts that are going to happen to education and social services because of that deficit. And then really the bulk of the time was given to public testimony and for legislators to hear the stories from the ground.
And it was incredible to hear over and over again, not just the context and the content of the harm that's being done and will be done with these newly proposed cuts, but the passion and anger and commitment to public schools that people have.
Yeah.
We actually recorded for KBOO, and we'll have some of that audio in the future on the show, but we will link to the full town hall on our website. Old Mole Variety Hour will give that information to folks at the end. Let's start then with, you know, what is the context right now? I mean, this is not new, and there are some competing forces here. It's not just that there are cuts, but that also the way that funding is being used it's not allocated correctly,
right,
towards things that actually make improvements.
Yeah, I'll say that, you know, we've knowingly underfunded education in the state for close to 25 years. So since Measure 5 passed, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about tax law because I don't, you know, that's not my expertise, but
we do have that audio.
Yes, yeah. We do. But this is also true for all social services in the state. We have a small, you know, we're all competing from this small pot of money, the general fund. And at the same time as this was happening, also nationally, there's this testing and accountability movement that kind of took hold in public education. And so what we have ended up doing is investing the meager resources we have into outcomes as opposed to actually spending our money on, you know, what directly impacts students. So we're currently measuring the results of our disinvestment. So poor graduation rates, opportunity gap for students of color, English language learners, special education students, students in poverty. And as Senator Lou Frederick pointed out on Saturday, testing isn't going to engage kids and keep them in school. What will engage kids is, you know, reasons to be there and connections with adults. And so, you know, listening to veteran teachers who talked about what it was like before we started disinvesting in school, you know, it was heartbreaking. So imagine if we had seven language options in high school: band, choir, home ec, woodshop, dance, painting, photography, clubs after school, team sports that were free that you didn't have to pay to participate in.
Yeah, my sister talks about that, and I'm always stunned about how much it costs her to allow her kids to actually play sports in their high school.
And it's a real equity issue. I mean, it mm-hmm. really does, you know, we talk about this accountability movement was supposedly to close a real gap, and this does not do it, you know. I also think that part of that reform narrative is that teachers and schools are failing, and wrapped up in that is the idea that unions are protecting bad teachers, and if we could just get rid of them, then everything would be hunky-dory. But if anyone understands what unions are protecting, it's due process so that people cannot just get fired unjustly. I mean, that's what they protect. But the other side of that is that, you know, this idea that schools are the great equalizer and that they are going to, you know, everybody who graduates is going to get to go to college and have a nice, stable, middle-class life. We know that that's not true.
Well, and one thing that comes out in the town hall in from teachers is this the level of outside stressors that we are in such a deeply insecure place all over the country, but of course Oregon is experiencing a great degree of homelessness and housing crisis, high rents. We could go on and on, but as school is a part of the fabric of our lives, for parents, for teachers, for kids, it's 9 months out of the year, and everything that's happening on the outside collapses to the inside, and public school teachers then are also expected to manage,
yeah,
to do more, you know, more people doing, fewer people doing more work, but also managing all of the complex realities that kids are dealing with, kids and their parents.
Yeah, I mean, you could really hear that in all the testimony yesterday that, you know, we have teachers who are so overloaded, many to the breaking point, no relief in sight. And as resources shrink, classroom sizes swell, it becomes more and more difficult to make those one-on-one connections and meet kids where they are. We're seeing the effects of poverty, housing insecurity, anxiety over immigration status, news stories about police violence against people of color, building a wall. All of this comes into the classroom. And, you know, I feel we heard yesterday the anxiety, the pain, the anger. These are people in the trenches every day, you know, doing this work that they love and they care so much about, and they're sick of begging for scraps. It has been so long. And, you know, more and more responsibility is piling on their shoulders with fewer resources to accomplish it. And there's really a sense of rage about how deeply unjust our system is. And we see corporations given tax breaks and able to make these insane profits, and people's lives are falling apart. And it's sickening, you know?
Right. And again, we'll direct folks to the audio of the town hall. I really encourage folks to listen. It was a couple of hours worth of time, but I think, you know, being able to hear what the panelists say, breaking these things down, giving the context, deep look at the context that we're talking about here is important to hear. There's of course this other big piece. We have about 30 seconds to deal with the market sickness. Really, we'll probably have to address that at another date. But of course, the attack on public employees, the privatization and market solution to these problems is not what we're looking for. We're looking to fund public schools and make them accessible and viable for all children.
Yeah, and it really is a civil right. I mean, we need to protect this. And I think that we've become, you know, so reliant on philanthropy, and it, you know, that's a couple of really wealthy people making a lot of really important educational decisions that they actually don't necessarily have the knowledge or experience to make those decisions and
right.
guide policy. So, revenue,
yeah.
investment,
yeah. Okay, well, excellent. We're out of time. We'll definitely address this again in the future, as the old mole likes to talk about schools, because we love public schools.
Well, thank you so much for recording and for having me on and really giving light to this issue.
Absolutely. Rachel Haynes, organizer of Death by a Thousand Cuts. Great title, by the way. And people did show up, even though, you know, it sounds kind of gruesome, and it is. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's membership time for KBOO.
500-526-66 or online at kboo.fm.
Please pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. Or you can donate online at kboo.fm. It's super easy.
Thank you, guys. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris. I've been your host this morning, and Joe Clement has been our engineer. Thanks to Will and Ken for helping us bulk up our membership. Remember, you can find the Old Mole Variety Hour on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Old Mole will be back next week as usual. Thanks again for all those who pledged this morning to support KBOO. We'll see you again, and we thank you so much.